All right, we're going to get started here with the next panel. I would like to welcome all of you, and I hope you all enjoyed the member reports, which is one of my favorite parts of the program. When I listen to you, I want you all to know how much I appreciate you and what you are all doing in your individual organizations. You are my friends, you are my colleagues, and you're my teachers in the conservative movement. Your work and your prayers are really appreciated. So I do want to tell you that you have a bit of homework, however. Your job, and I'm sure you all know this, is to find and train your replacement so the important work that you do in your own organizations can go on. Now some ground rules. I want to remind everyone to silence your cell phones and please do not record any speaker remarks. As you've been told earlier in our meetings, CNP meetings are off limits to the press, so please be aware of who you're talking to, especially in the hotel common areas and in the elevators. Don't grant any interviews, and if you run into a reporter asking questions about the event, please let a member of the CNP staff or leadership team know immediately. Staff are all wearing green name tags, and they're around in this room, often in the back of the rooms, and certainly out in the halls, so find someone or find one of the officers and let us know. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Bill Walton to lead the morning's first panel on Trump's trade and economic policies. Bill Walton is managing partner of Rappahannock Ventures, a private investment firm. He served in President Trump's transition team as the leader of the agency action and landing teams for all the federal economic agencies and was chairman and CEO of Allied Capital Corporation. Bill is vice president of CNP, chairman of CNP Action, and a senior fellow at Discovery Institute's Center on Wealth, Poverty, and Morality. He also hosts a weekly podcast, The Bill Walton Show. Bill and his wife, Sarah, live in Washington, Virginia with their three terriers, some of whom can often be heard barking on our conference calls. Bill?
Thanks, Andy. So yesterday I'm riding down in an elevator with Keith Lewis, and someone on the elevator, not a member, asked us what our name tags are about. And Keith gave a good formal description of CNP, and then I said, "We're here to solve the nation's problems, make America great again." Right? And then he asked, "What's the one biggest problem that you think we have to solve?" The one biggest thing, I think, education. We have a couple generation of kids who don't know anything. No, it's worse than that. What they've been taught and learned in school is absolutely wrong, and in some cases, evil. For example, economic education. Exhibit A, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But it's worse than that. Just many kids don't know anything about economics. The entire Democrat Party is now enthralled to this stunningly stupid little girl who knows with certainty things about economics that are both absolutely wrong and evil. She's leading them down the path for the U.S. to become Venezuela. And they all seem to be happy with the word socialism. Look at the Democrat agenda emerging from Congress and the Democrats who want to be president. 16 senators have endorsed Medicare for All, which is Bernie Sanders' plan to replace all private health insurance with federally administered single-payer health care program. Government would decide what care to deliver, what drugs to pay for, and how much to pay doctors and hospitals. Private insurance would be banned. We also have, of course, we've all heard about the Green New Deal, and this requires the U.S. become carbon neutral within 10 years. Now, non-carbon sources only provide 11% of our energy today. And so what this means is a wholesale reorganization and dismantling of electric power, transportation, and manufacturing in the United States. And all this would be planned by a, and I quote, a select committee for a Green New Deal. The Soviets could not have named it better. The Green New Deal would also provide guaranteed government job for all through a, quote, job guarantee program to assure a living wage job to every person who wants one. Democrats AOC leading the charge is calling for a top death tax rate of 77%. They want to raise the highest marginal tax rate, income tax rate, to 70%. And they want to raise the payroll tax to almost 15% from 12.4%. And also the new idea that's never been tried in the United States, it was tried in France and they got rid of it because it was totally destructive, is they want to impose a wealth tax, which would be a 2% tax on assets above 50 million and a 3% tax on assets above a billion. Now, of course, this is like the income tax. Started out in 1912, there was a 3% tax on, I think it was about 3% of the US population based on income, and of course we know where that led. This wealth tax would end up with the same terrible result. And these are just the highlights out of dozens of equally bad ideas. And so the Democrats, especially the young, have bought into the social agenda at a time when the U.S. is enjoying the strongest economy in living memory, thanks to some of the changes that President Trump has put in place. But it's also a time we face real and pressing economic issues. We're still $22 trillion in debt and growing at a rate now of about $1 trillion a year. And the Republicans, which are hardly a check on Democrats, continue to vote for record budget-busting spending bills. And we also need, as a country, to deal with the global debt bubble, China, monetary policy, and a global economic slowdown. So here to provide some adult supervision and guidance, and to help us sort out the important economic issues, are three experts who cover the waterfront on all things economic. Steve Moore is Distinguished Visiting Fellow at the Project for Economic Growth at the Heritage Foundation. Earlier in his career, he was spent several years at Heritage as the Grover Herman Fellow in Budgetary Affairs. He formerly wrote on the economy and public policy for the Wall Street Journal and served on the editorial board of the journal. He founded the Free Enterprise Fund and calls his creation of the Club for Growth the defining moment of his career. Steve, welcome. Richard Rahn serves as chairman of the Institute for Global Economic Growth and the Improbable Success Productions. He writes a syndicated weekly column published in the Washington Times and Real Clear Markets. He served two terms as member of the board of directors of the Cayman Monetary Authority, which regulates the world's largest offshore financial center. Also, he had a long, distinguished career at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He's the author of The End of Money and the Struggle for Financial Privacy, and he's testified before the U.S. Congress on economic issues more than 75 times. Jonathan Williams is chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council and vice president of its Center for Fiscal State Reform. Jonathan is a contributor to The Hill and a columnist at Tax Analyst. He has spoken to audiences in all 50 states and provided testimony for the U.S. Congress and numerous state legislative bodies. His work has been featured by the White House, Congressional Economic Joint Economic Committee, and the U.S. House Committee on Ways and Means. He is a recipient of the Ludwig von Mises Award in Economics. Jonathan, welcome. We're going to kick this off. Steve's going to talk a bit about the Trump economy. Richard's going to give us an overview of where we are globally, and Jonathan's going to tell us what's happening in the States. Steve?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me back to CMP, and thank you so much, Bill, for mentioning my new book, Trumponomics. So if you haven't gotten that, if you want to stimulate the economy, go to Amazon and buy that.
Bill's new book is Trumponomics.
I was thinking Bill and I were at CNP exactly 3 years ago when Donald Trump was running for president. And there were, at that time, still a lot of skeptics about whether Donald Trump was a real conservative. You remember that, Bill, when we spoke about that. And how many of you agree now that Donald Trump is a real conservative? I mean, this guy is amazing in terms of what he has done on the economy. So I'm very proud of having worked with Trump on the campaign. Larry Kudlow and I were the senior. By the way, how cool is it Larry Kudlow is the most important economist in the world today? I mean, does it get any better than that? And so Larry and I worked together on the economic program. I thought I'd just give you a few of the kind of highlights of what is going on. If you would please put up some of these charts. I'm going to go through these very quickly. I have 8 minutes, so I'm just going to give a quick overview of how Trump has really provided and created this American Renaissance. And I'll just start with a few charts here. Let me just start with this. I mean, I was on CNN. By the way, I'm also with fake news now. I'm with CNN. Incidentally, I was on last night. How many of you live in New York in this room? How many New Yorkers are there here? Aren't you totally embarrassed by what your state? I mean, what a disgrace of what's happened in the last 48 hours in New York. And I was on last night, late last night, talking about the Amazon fiasco. And this, this woman I was on with saying, and by the way, your friend AOC, Alexandria Cortez, said, yesterday, we don't need your stinking 25,000 jobs. 25,000 jobs. They snubbed their nose at them. Those jobs are now going to leave New York, and they're probably going to end up in Nashville, Tennessee. And the attitude of the left is, we don't want those jobs. We don't like rich people like Jeff Bezos. And they've thumbed their nose. This is a place, by the way, as Jonathan will tell you, how many? They've lost 1.3 million people on net in the last 10 years. They are one of the most economically depressed states in the country, and they're thumbing their nose at 25,000 jobs. So add that to your list of stupidity on the left. But anyway, so the day before I was on CNN, and we had this awesome jobs report, 300,000 new jobs. By the way, another interesting little side point. The month of January, when we had this blockbuster jobs report for virtually an all-time high in private sector employment, the government was shut down. Maybe that should tell you how important government is to growth of our economy, and maybe we should keep a lot of those agencies closed for good, right? Maybe those non-essential activities should be closed for good. But anyway, so the jobs report came out, and I was debating this woman from the Washington Post, and they're having a hard time. Liberals are having a very difficult time now explaining how it is that this president, who if he was elected, remember he was going to cause the second Great Depression, if you're elected. Now we have, as you just said, Bill, the best economy, certainly since Reagan, and in some ways even better, the lowest unemployment rate since the Beatles were still playing together. I mean, these amazing statistics. And so this woman said, what they're saying now, have you noticed? They say, oh, this is just the Obama economy, right? This is just, a continuation of the trends under Obama. And so the host said, Steve, is this just the Obama effect? And I said, well, absolutely this is the Obama effect. This is the effect that Barack Obama is no longer president of the United States. That's why we have this booming economy. So as evidence of this, look at this is the Trump effect. I mean, look at this. By the way, these are snapshots taken literally 48 hours after the election. Look what happened to small business optimism. 2 days after the election, it went through the roof, and small business optimism has been at an all-time high now for the last 3 years. Consumer sentiment, same thing. Look at that. 2 days after the election, an all-time high reading on consumer sentiment. And then one of my favorites, just there's a poll that's been asked for the last 40 years, every 6 months. How do you rate the economy? Poor, fair, good, or great? 2 weeks before Barack Obama, before the election in November of 2016, that poll was taken. 3 out of 10 Americans rated the economy as good or great. You know what that number is today? 8 out of 10. 8 out of 10 Americans rate the economy as good or great. Something big is going on. This is the Trump effect. So what is the Trump effect? What is he doing? One is obviously something we all agree with, is deregulation. And this just shows you the trend in the first year. By the way, we just got the 2018 numbers. They're down another 14%. So almost a 50% decline in regulation. That's awesome. This is my favorite Time magazine cover of all time. And I just love this one, Bill, because this was put out exactly a year ago by the Time editors. It proves that these people are, it's like they're on Venus and we're on Mars. They have no idea what we're talking about. So they put out this cover. This is supposed to be a criticism of Donald Trump. The wrecking crew, how Trump's cabinet is dismantling government as we know it. Well, hell yes, we're dismantling government. That's why we elected the guy, right? Of course we're dismantling government. That's the whole point. How stupid are these people? Then on trade, Richard and I are going to have a little discussion on this later, but I'll just say this. I came around to when Larry Kudlow and I first met with Donald Trump 3 years ago, we had a debate dispute with Donald Trump about trade. We're free traders, and he's more of a trade protectionist. And I remember we said, Donald, you're a trade protectionist. He slammed down his fist, and he said, I'm not a trade protectionist. I believe in free trade. I just want a level playing field, and I want to make sure these other countries are playing by the rules. And I'll kind of submit this to you, Richard, because I want your response on this. I mean, when I started looking at the evidence, it turned out that Donald Trump did have a point. And what you're looking at here is from the Council of Economic Advisors, our friend Kevin Hassett, and it shows that the United States does have virtually the lowest tariffs in the world. I think there are two countries, Hong Kong and Australia, that have lower tariffs than we do. But it is true, we have free trade deals with a lot of these countries, and guess what? They aren't playing by the rules. Trump has a point here. And what we're trying to do, by the way, a project that we're kind of working on is to, you know, I love this. Trump is saying, we'll go to zero if you go to zero. And by the way, the Europeans and all these countries, oh God, no, not zero. But you know, there. Look at China, by the way. And I'll just simply say this. I think Donald Trump deserves a lot of credit for being the first president in, you know, 50, well, it's really only been a recent phenomenon since really the last 15 years. How many of you with me on this? And Donald Trump, China is no longer a friend. They are no longer an ally. They are an enemy and an adversary. Right, they are an enemy and an adversary, and everything they are doing is hostile to the United States right now militarily. What they're doing is dangerous and hostile. You're seeing they're hacking into our computer systems, the industrial espionage. They're stealing $300 billion of our technology every year. Donald Trump is fighting the right fight against China right now, and this is one that he cannot back down on. So I think this is the most important thing for the economy. Now, I'll tell you where I disagree with Donald Trump. Something that I think he's done that's been very counterproductive is these steel tariffs. The steel tariffs, look, Donald Trump's heart is in the right place. He cares about steel workers, and he cares about blue-collar workers in America. That's how we won the election. So you can see here, we have saved steel jobs, no question about it. He'll say, oh, look, a factory just opened up with 800 steel workers. The problem is, for every steel worker that we have in the United States, we have 50 manufacturers that use steel. And so we're actually losing more jobs in some of these industries than we're gaining because of the higher costs of steel. So I think those have been counterproductive. And then I'll turn it over. How great is this story? The United States of America, for the first time in our history, is producing more oil and gas than we're selling. We are a net exporter of oil, and this nitwit AOC wants to eliminate that. I mean, that's probably 10 million jobs right down the drain. So that's, you know, crazy. We are going to continue to produce our oil and gas. We're going to be the Saudi Arabia of the 21st century in oil and gas production. And then finally, and I promise, Bill, this is my last point, but let me just go back to this because it's interesting. None of the other countries that signed the Paris Climate Accord, not one of those countries has met their targets. What country in the world reduced its carbon emissions the most in 2017? Anybody know? United States of America. Why? Because we have natural gas. Natural gas reduces global warming, and yet AOC wants to get rid of natural gas. What a nitwit. And then finally, and I'll just show you this last thing, and then I'll stop. This is the heart of what we did. We cut the business tax rate from 40 to 20%. You can see that the green pillars are the rates that are charged by every other country. The rest of the world was higher than we were in the 1990s. They've been aggressively cutting their tax rates. Why are they doing that? Because they love their companies? No, the reason they've been doing that is to steal jobs and factories from the United States, and they were doing it. And so we showed this very chart to Donald Trump. And we were at Farley, and we said, Larry and I showed, look, because Donald Trump likes to look at pictures, he doesn't like to read, and so we showed him this, and we said, look, you know, we're at 40, they're at 20, this is a big problem, we've got to go to 20, you know, and Trump looked at this, it's such a great moment, and Trump looked at this, and he said, no, I don't want to do that. We're like, Donald, don't you understand, we're at 40, 20, this is like a 20% Head Start program for every country we're competing with, it's unpatriotic, and so on. So Trump looks at this, and he says, no. Not 20, I want 15. I want 15. Now, this is probably the first time, Richard, in history, that any politician has gotten to the right of me and you and Larry Kudlow in cutting tax rates. And so he insisted on 15. And the end of the story, the reason that's interesting, is that from that day in June of 2016 through December 19, 2017, the day before the tax bill passed, every meeting Donald Trump was in, every single public declaration, every speech he gave, 15, 15, 15. I was in some of these meetings. He'd meet with congressional leaders, and he'd say to them, don't even bother to come back with a tax bill unless you give me a 15% corporate rate. Well, the last day, we had to get to 50 votes in the Senate. It was always whether we could get to 50. And the last day, we're at the White House. We're waiting for Mitch McConnell to come back from the Republican conference to see if we had the 50 votes. We had to pass that bill before Christmas or it wouldn't have happened. And I'll never forget, Mitch McConnell walks into the room in the White House, walks right up to the president. He says, Mr. President, I'm just so sorry. I have to tell you, I failed you. I did everything I possibly could. I made all the arguments with our caucus. I'm so sorry, sir. I couldn't get you that 15% rate on the business taxes. He said, would you take 20%? And Trump says, in a New York minute, I'll take 20%. Now, what's interesting about that, just this last final insight, I am convinced, I learned a lot from Donald Trump in that episode, because if Donald Trump had taken Larry Kudlow's and my advice and started at 20, Bill, there is no doubt in my mind, absolutely no doubt, we would have ended up at 25 or 26 or 27. Donald Trump understands the art of the deal. He's the greatest negotiator ever. We got the 20% tax rate, and the economy is booming. All right, I'm done.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Steve, Richard, you're up next. You called AOC a nitwit. Isn't that giving her a lot of credit?
As usual, Steve has it wrong. The correct tax rate for both corporations and capital gains is zero. And Steve at one time believed that, but when you're looking for a job in administration, you know, you sell out. Steve and I have known each other many decades. We're good friends. And now the good news about AOC is that her policies, as Steve pointed out, are driving millions of New Yorkers elsewhere, Florida, a lot of other places. And of course, we give the number of congressional districts based on population. And with a little bit of luck, by the year 2020, when we do our new redistricting, New York will lose many more seats, and hopefully one of them will be hers. Normally, I'm the optimist. When CNP was first formed, I was a frequent speaker here, and I was given the optimist thing. I'm old enough to be part of the Reagan team. And today, I've got more of a pessimistic message for you. And that is, even though we are booming, and the president is right, we have the strongest big economy in the world. But the world is a mess, and particularly debt. Our debt here in the U.S. is $22 trillion now. But if you look at the debt-GDP ratios around the world in the big economies, they're all growing. And as Herb Stein used to say, if something can't continue, it won't. And this debt buildup cannot continue. But there are basic fundamental things that are driving it, and it's basically demographics. As you may know, Japan is shrinking. Population is falling each year. Russia is shrinking. Much of Europe is shrinking. Italy, the Balkans, virtually all of Eastern Europe, they're all getting smaller. Smaller and smaller populations. The pressure, of course, with politicians is to spend more money, and particularly as the population gets older. So you have an aging population. Japan is really the poster child here, and China is coming along rapidly because the Chinese had this one-child policy, and now after 30 years, it's caught up with them because you have some of these people beginning to retire, and there's going to be a huge amount of retirement increases in China with a smaller and smaller workforce. This can't be sustained. And I was struck. I'm basically more of an economic conservative. I usually don't talk too much about the social issues. But I'm a Virginian. And when our governor went out there and said, oh, you know, we have the child, and then we decide whether or not to kill him after he's born. This whole attitude, even if you take out the religious component of it, from strictly an economic, mathematical standpoint, cannot work. Just think about it. You have fewer and fewer children, an aging workforce, more and more people living longer because of our great advances in medical technology. The people have to be supported. And the math just doesn't work. And this is a global problem. It'll hit other places before it hits the U.S. in a big way. We've already seen it in Greece. The Greeks had been spending way too much. And finally, the Germans and the IMF and so forth said, well, we're not going to loan you much more until you cut back some. The average Greek now has a per capita income about 30% lower than they did 6 years ago. Just think about it when it happens in this country. Suddenly, we have a huge drop in incomes of that level. It doesn't have to happen. We still have time to correct it here. But globally, it's happening. Even places like Mexico, people don't realize how birth rates have fallen in places like Mexico and much of Latin America. They're now down below replacement levels. You have to have about 2.1 children for the average woman to keep population at a steady state. I mean, there's always a lag. So the population globally will grow the next few decades, but then it's going to drop off very rapidly. Here in the U.S., because of immigration, we're still up around, we're still growing some, and we have a sustainable situation for a while. But we take a place like, again, Italy. Italy has a gross debt of nearly 200% of the GDP. The net debt's about 128%. When I was a kid, we used to talk about big Italian families. They're no longer big Italian families. The average Italian woman only has 1.2 children. You go to much of Italy, and there's towns, cities, who've been basically abandoned. That's true all through the Balkans, many of these other places. This is just all unsustainable. And I had been a professional economist, but also done business and things over the years, and they wanted action items. Well, the action items first is educate our fellow man about what is happening, that this demographic, global demographic crisis we're in cannot be sustained. But I was looking at the money. I did this book, End of Money, I did it more than 20 years ago. And I was lucky to know both Milton Friedman and F.A. Hayek, and particularly Hayek had done a great book, Denationalization of Currency. And he talked about how we didn't need to have government producing our money. Historically, money had been produced privately, and you could use commodity baskets and so forth. Well, I was intrigued by this. The book was written in 1976, and in later years, I talked to him about it, and that was sort of motivated me to write my own book on where money was headed. But we had the problem, when you go to digital money, of the counterfeiting, the double spending problem. And having been a central banker, I understand this, you know, that you have to, when you go to digital money, it's pretty easy to counterfeit, except we had the great innovation of the blockchain and great advances in cryptography over the last decade or so. So now we've basically solved that problem, and we can go to digital money. But the problem is, if governments take it on, they'll still have the tendency to inflate the currency. So we don't have to rely on government money anymore. So I've set up a company, actually down in Miami, with a few very smart people, where we're doing developing a money, which will start actually off as a better way of transferring metal commodities around the world. But this will be all private, be encrypted. you'll have privacy. And as the government monies become less and less, I mean, we're a long way from Venezuela, but we'll get there unless we make these fundamental changes, to give people an individual way out. You people are entrepreneurs, and you believe in the private market. I believe in the private market. So after years of struggling with public policy and doing the kind of things that my colleagues do here, of endless articles and speeches, I said, this isn't getting us where we need to be, so I'm going to build a private alternative. And if anybody's interested in learning more about that, give me your card or come up and I'll explain it to you in more detail. But there are ways that those of us as private free people can get out under the yoke of government despite the global demographic crisis and debt crisis. Thank you all so much.
Jonathan?
Well, good morning, everybody, and greetings from the land of make-believe, Washington, D.C., where we are based. And as Reagan would always say, Washington is an island surrounded by reality. So anytime I get a chance to get off the island and into reality, I always take that opportunity. And it's really a pleasure to follow my colleagues today. And what I am going to talk about is how federal tax reform, the Trump Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, has been a game changer at the state level. And that's where we spend a lot of our time as we are working with our 2,000 state legislators at ALEC. I know many of you are familiar with us. We've been around 45 years now and devoted to free markets, limited government, and federalism. Anybody a fan of those principles in this room, hopefully, right? I think we got a few fans in this room of those principles. So I have a few slides today I wanted to talk about and what we do and what we're seeing in the state level. Because guess what? The positive news, let me bring this back a little bit positive. Steve started, we were going to go back and forth. It's important to talk about the real issues out there. But there are some very positive stories going on at the state level right now. And, you know, we have these 50 laboratories of democracy. And that's something God, you know, really, I think, imparted in their founders the wisdom to create our system. When we go across the world and we're talking with foreign leaders and their elected representatives, they are really puzzled by our system of federalism and that states have to compete for people. And when states compete, guess what? People win. And that's what we're seeing across the states. And what federal tax reform did, let me go into the weeds really quickly here. I promise I won't stay into the weeds. I'm a tax economist by training. But what happened is with federal tax reform, the first federal tax reform in 31 long years, in fact, Top Gun was number one at the box office last time we did federal tax reform. That's how long it was. We had some good tax relief in the Bush years and other things with capital gains and dividends, but this is the first remake. And what happened now is because of the federal base broadening, that is, because of the federal government broadening the tax base, lowering the rates, doing away with things like the personal exemption and other items, and then lowering rates and offering some other great provisions for taxpayers, what we saw was, is at the federal level, we saw a huge tax cut for the vast majority of Americans. But how does that translate to the state level? The big thing at the state level is every state, the 41 states that have state income taxes, at least, start with federal taxable income or federal adjusted gross income to start their state tax calculations outside of Pennsylvania and a couple of other states. So when the federal tax base is broad, state tax bases automatically are broadened out. So if states do nothing, they have a huge revenue in a windfall that they're seeing. And that's exactly what we're seeing play out across the states this year. So state legislators that we work with are actually seeing major surpluses. So the battle today is over, do you spend the money or do you give it back to hardworking taxpayers? And that is the existential debate that we're seeing play out at the state level. And of course, one of my favorite economists, Thomas Sowell, always put that battle this way. What is the first law of economics? We have a scarcity of resources, right? But on the other hand, the first law of politics is to ignore the first law of economics, right? And so that's how it's playing out. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a big battle at the state level. But the good news is, do we have people from, let's say, Iowa or Missouri here? Your two states enacted the largest tax relief in state history this last year as a direct result of federal tax reform, the base issues translating over the surplus dollars, We saw Idaho, we saw Georgia. Even Bernie Sanders, Vermont, by the way, cut income taxes this year because of the massive amount of budget surpluses coming in to the state. Isn't that remarkable that even Vermont is cutting taxes because of what this phenomenon meant at the Trump tax reform level? So let me get to a couple of slides. I had a piece in Drudge Report this week talking about the very issue that Richard raised, and that is when states are competing, who is winning when it comes to this competition for population? Here's over the last 10 years alone. I was actually just with Secretary Perry. The big winner is Texas over the last 10 years with the in-migration on net of more than 1.3 million Americans over the last 10 years. Isn't that incredible, what free markets, no income tax at the Texas state level, and so many other good policies do? And he said, you know what, the technical term for that is when Texas gains 1.3 million new people, that's a whole lot of new pickup trucks. And that is the technical term for Texas. And of course, Florida's not too far behind with almost 800,000, almost 900,000 in migration, North Carolina, Arizona, and Colorado. You notice a common theme to the governing philosophy in most of the states. Now, go over to the right side of the column, what is happening in the states of AOC and the states that follow really the formula that Ronald Reagan warned us about. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. If it stops moving, what? Subsidize it, right? And guess what? When the deal came to Amazon, New York had to give away for the same number of jobs. They split it 25,000, 25,000. Virginia and New York originally was the deal. They had to give away 5 to 6 times more than Virginia did for the same number of jobs. That is because their overall business climate is toxic. Clearly, their political system with individuals trying to shake down Amazon after making the decision is toxic. And of course, that's the reality, is they're losing people as they vote with their feet. California, we've got a few Californians I talked to here, nearly down 1 million over the last decade. I was just in Springfield, Illinois. Illinois is a state that is hollowing out, outside of Chicago especially, down over 700,000 over the last decade. And let me fast forward to what it means for the congressional seats. And we're going to get to the 2020 estimate. That's what my piece on Drudge did this week. But this goes back 50 years. And guess what? New York is down, because of this out-migration, New York is down 14 congressional districts on net over the last 50 years. That's probably a good thing there's not more AOCs roaming the halls of Congress, right? But it is incredible that they do not see the error in the way of the big government high tax philosophy. And of course, look at Pennsylvania, look at Illinois, look at those trends over the last 50 years of people leaving and the political consequences. Now, fake news economist Paul Krugman would come back and say, well, only people are moving to Florida and Texas because of the weather, right? That is, literally they will say that with a straight face, like legislators in state capitals can control the weather. But here are two places where the weather is so great that you never want to leave once you go. But what's happening in those places? Hawaii has actually lost more Americans than it's gained 8 out of the last 10 years. And we just talked about the California example. Folks, nobody moves from California to Texas for the weather, right? It just doesn't happen that way. But why are people leaving California? And that is the big answer that we need to get to and explain why conservative ideas are winning in this race for people voting with their feet across states. And here's what the 2020 likely map looks like as of the most recent census numbers that just came out. We're getting awfully close to the 2020 census when this becomes official. But the big winners of 2020 will be Texas, which will gain 2 to 3 new U.S. House seats. Florida will gain 2 new congressional seats at least. And then Arizona, Colorado, Montana, North Carolina, and Oregon will be the other seats that have gained, states that will gain seats. And the losers, by the way, New York and Illinois are going to be the big losers of 2020, losing at least 1, if not 2 seats per state in this census. And of course, many other states there. Rhode Island, interestingly enough, this will be the first time in state history since 1790 that they will be down to 1 U.S. House seat because of the out-migration and the bad policies that have come out of a state like Rhode Island. And if it wasn't bad enough, here's some survey data that I believe Gallup did, that they surveyed residents of Connecticut and New Jersey and other high-tax states and said, if you had the opportunity to leave your state and go someplace else, would you? And it turns out that 50% nearly in Connecticut and New Jersey would leave if they had the economic opportunity. And one of the key findings we put together, and we're passing around free copies of our book, Rich States, Poor States, that I author with Steve Moore here and Arthur Laffer, is just how much income taxes matter. We talked a lot about the big winners and the big losers in this race for competition, and what federal tax reform really set off is more competition. And it turns out, though, that the states that avoid personal income taxes down the ride. Here, this is a 10 years worth of data. This is not cherry picking 1 year worth of data, whether you look at gross state product growth, population growth, job growth, or, by the way, even tax receipt growth. The no-income tax states are winning in this race. And it gets back to the great Jack Kemp, the hero of tax reform of the 1980s, would say the way to raise revenue and to be sustainable with your budgets is not by raising tax rates, it's by increasing the number of taxpayers coming into your state. So while Texas is not having an income tax charge for all of its new residents, guess what? Those hundreds of thousands and millions of new people coming into Texas are paying taxes. And this afternoon, we're going to talk about, and probably the most difficult question I ever get as I go around the 50 states to tell this story, is this: what happens when liberal individuals leave high tax states, go for economic opportunity, and go to conservative states and don't lose their liberal ideas? So come back this afternoon and we're going to be addressing that question. Thank you very much.
And this afternoon we're going to be talking about the red states and their immigration laws and keeping blue state people out. Steve suggested a wall. Could we keep all the mics on? Because I think these folks are going to want to interreact. Something that really hasn't been brought up is the labor market. And Orrin Cass has written a book recently, but he says that in our economic policies that are pushing for growth and high GDP and lower cost goods and things like that, that we've forgotten the labor market. And that one of the reasons that Donald Trump is president is we've got lots of people in lots of states that had great jobs 50 years ago and they don't now, and our economic policies have not really addressed that. I'm not arguing income inequality here, but I am saying there have been a lot of job losses, a lot of people out of the labor force. What do we do about that?
Well, let me start on that. First of all, you know, when I talked about how great the Trump economy is, if you just want one statistic, because this one just blows me away, and liberals have a hard time explaining how this happened. Today in the United States, according to the latest Bureau of Labor Statistics, we have 7.2 million more jobs than people to fill them. Has that ever happened in the United States, ever? 7.2 million, that's larger than the entire population of Indiana or Missouri. So we're talking about a huge surplus of jobs today. In fact, everywhere I go, Bill, I'm on the road everywhere. You know, I'm on the road 2 or 3 days a week. I go everywhere from Orlando from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine, to Denver, to Nashville, to San Francisco, San Diego, even cities like Detroit and Cleveland. A couple of just interesting observations. Right now in the United States, we're in the midst of the biggest construction boom in the history of the United States. Never seen anything like it. I mean, every city you go to, all you see is buildings being erected, factories being erected, and it's a burst of optimism. People feel good that we replaced a community organizer with a businessman, and that was a pretty good trade, right? And so now we have this constraint, Bill, which is we are running out of workers. Now, there's two problems here. One is that, you know, a lot of the jobs today require, you know, skill sets that Americans don't have. We're you know, educating people. We're paying $200,000 a year for a college education, and you know, they're coming out with degrees that aren't very valuable. You know, it's a shame. I mean, a good friend of mine, Bob Funk, who runs the biggest employment agency in the United States, says anyone who has a useful skill, who actually knows how to do something, you can find a job in 48 hours. In the United States.
Well, so does that lead us to what a smart immigration policy?
Yeah, so no, what we need is, yeah. So what is the solution to this? Number one, look, I don't believe we're actually running out of workers. There's 10 million Americans of working age that could be and should be working that aren't working. And then the question is, why aren't they working? And one of the reasons is because we've had, you know, under Obama, basically we replaced work with disability payments, food stamps, Medicaid, all these programs. Every single government program, every single government welfare program should have a work requirement, right? Every single one of them. And by the way, we flinched on this when we passed the food stamps bill this past year. Republicans flinched on this.
Yeah.
And so the other thing we need is we need more skill-based.
Richard, Jonathan, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, it's interesting that you got all these people saying, well, we're going to robots and AI.
Exactly.
And this is going to cause millions or tens of millions of people to lose their jobs. If you go back through history, the same arguments were made in England in the 1750s. Cyrus McCormick invented the Reaper in Virginia, I think it was 1823. And this was going to destroy the labor market. 90% of Americans worked on farms. Well, of course, all these innovations create many more jobs than they destroy.
No doubt.
And I mean, I look around the group here, I expect that some of you might be older than 65. And I expect that a number of you who are older than 65 still do productive things. I'm going to point out a couple of my colleagues, Richard Vigory and Ed Meese. We're a part of a little dinner group in Northern Virginia. And virtually none of the, I don't think anybody in the dinner group is less than 65. But all of them are doing productive things. And the wonderful thing about technologies, it enables us to continue to work, the kind of work we enjoy. Now, when I was a kid, I worked on construction gangs here in Florida. I don't want to go out and haul concrete blocks anymore. I got to do about two a day. And I hated it when I was 15. But there's all kinds of work that most of us enjoy that we do. And we're adding to GDP and making lives better for our fellow man. So technology is actually work expanding rather than work contracting. And I know that's counterintuitive, but don't worry about the new technologies. They'll create many new jobs. Yes, we won't have as many truck drivers. Trucks will become automated. But those truck drivers will actually do more productive things.
So can I have one other quick thing about this?
Well,
this is a really important topic. It's just I neglected to mention one thing. You know, you're talking about, you know, older people. Actually, if you look at the labor force participation rates, because I've been doing some analysis of this, actually older people actually have a higher labor force. They're people when they were at age 55, 60, 65, 70, 75 actually are more likely to be working today than they were 20 or 25 years ago. Here is the cancer cell in our economy right now. The big decline in the labor force, and you, when you said, you know, hauling around, you know, concrete at the age of 15, the big problem we have right now is that young people are working at much lower rates, and that is a big economic problem, Bill, because I've been looking at the economic research. The earlier you start working, the higher your lifetime earnings. This idea that we should have 13-year-olds working. I mean, look, I mean, seriously.
And a minimum wage that keeps...
When I was at the Wall Street Journal, we had so many successful people coming in of all areas of life, business, finance, art, music, sports, you know, whatever area. And I'd always ask these people, you know, about their past. You know, where did you grow up? And what was so interesting, I'd see over half of these extremely successful people, you know where they grew up? On a farm. You know why that's interesting? If you grow up on a farm, you start working when you're 11 years old, right?
Jonathan,
if not easier.
Jonathan,
so we have got to get young people working.
I want to add one thing to that.
Steve, just a moment. Jonathan got to get a word.
One quick thing here. When I was 16, I worked on a dairy farm.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you ever worked on a dairy farm, but more than anything else, that convinced me I wanted to get an education.
Exactly.
I didn't want to haul hay bales anymore. It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah,
and
I had the same experience you did.
So your point on young workers is exactly right. And I actually was in Annapolis this week giving a talk, and I was working with the one of the contractors association. I had lunch with a friend there, and he was talking about the proposal for the $15 an hour minimum wage that's floating around a lot of state capitals this year.
Yeah.
This is the AOC type proposal that governors and state legislators are trying to export those bad ideas. And you know what? My friend was telling me, and these are unionized contractors in many cases in Maryland, a heavily heavily unionized state, and he said, guess what? If Maryland passes this $15 an hour minimum wage, they might sound sanctimonious and they're doing the progressive right thing, but guess what? That's going to mean that our apprenticeship program goes away. It absolutely goes away. And this is being paid for by union firms, and this is going to give those young workers their first rung on the economic ladder. And that's so discouraging, because when you ask about the labor market, I mean, what we're seeing nationally is such a bifurcated answer to that. In, you know, the growth states, the economy is so strong right now, and the wage growth is through the roof. Unemployment is non-existent. Real estate is booming if you're a growth state within migration that we talked about. But on the other hand, if you follow that approach of big government states that are losing population, one of the things that's always stood out to me is the disincentive that big government programs place on work. And there was a statistic done, I think it was by the Pennsylvania HHS secretary under the last Republican administration, that he pointed out that to break even, a single mother with one child would need a job around $70,000 a year just to break even. Otherwise, it's more valuable to that person to stay on government benefits and not enter the workforce. Folks, that's a problem. Economics 101, right?
Hey, Jonathan, what about labor mobility? What about people moving from state to state? Is that slowing down?
On that, Bill?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Jonathan, something I'm very confused about. Maybe you can help me. If government can just pass higher wages and doesn't have an adverse effect, you mentioned this woman, $70,000, why not have a minimum wage of $100 an hour? Can you explain?
Exactly.
Why are these people... Why do they want to limit to $15 an hour? Let's make everybody rich.
Well, I hope AOC is not listening in.
You're the real progressive, Richard. Yeah, there you go.
So we haven't talked much about debt and $22 trillion that's out there. Is this, are we going to get buried by this someday?
Well, with debt, think about your home mortgage. How much of a mortgage was... Think of it back when you were younger, and you probably had a big mortgage, which was a burden to you. How much could you take on? And there were several variables: the size of the mortgage, your income level, and the interest rate. If interest rates went up, you could afford less debt. If they went down, you could afford more debt. If your income went up faster than your interest payments, you were fine. So the situation we now have globally is interest rates have been very low for the last decade or so, which has given an illusion that we're better off than we are. But if interest rates go back up to normal, I think we're spending $225 billion on interest right now, and we'd be back up, what's it, 875 or something like that?
If they go up to 2%, it wipes out all the discretionary spending.
Yeah, just exactly. Okay. Then what happens?
Yeah,
and we're going to see this around the world, and people say, well, there hasn't been a crisis yet, but a small increase in interest rates, or if the debt just keeps growing as a percentage of GDP, as it is, at some point, the party is over.
So look, you know, people always ask me, what is the essence of Trumponomics? I mean, what is the book about? You know, what is Trump trying to achieve with Trumponomics? And I think it comes down to something that Larry and I just pounded into him that he got instinctively, which is grow the economy. If you look at these forecasts for the U.S., I mean, look, you're exactly right. The only area where I disagree with you, Richard, I agree with you. The rest of the world's in big, big trouble. But we've got it pretty right in the United States because everybody said Trump couldn't get growth up to 3%. Guess what the growth rate was in 2018? 3.1%. Not in 1 year under Obama's 8 years did we get 3% growth. And in Trump's second year, we're already at 3.1. Now, why is that important? If you look at those numbers that show this very scary trend of upward rise in the debt, it goes from like 80% of GDP to 150%, so we look like Detroit and Puerto Rico. We can't allow that future to happen. What you have to do, obviously you have to cut spending, you have to do a lot of the things Richard is talking about, but a precondition to making any progress on the debt is to get growth up. Because the CBO is predicting Richard, over the next 30 years, we grow at 1.8%. Hell no, we're not growing at 1.8%. We're growing at 3 to 4%. We're going to get this growth rate up. And if you get the growth rate to, say, 3.25, the debt goes down as a share of GDP every year, not up. And so growth is the key here. And that means we do need, you know, more of these economic programs. And by the way, there is no law of nature. I don't care what your friend Larry Summers says, who's the president of Harvard. He was the chief economist for Obama and for Clinton. He put out a very famous study that every liberal believes that the United States economy can no longer, what do they call it, secular stagnation. The economy can't grow more than 2%. Now, the reason they believe that is because they threw every dingbat liberal idea at the recession in 2009. You know, Obamacare tax increases, flooded the economy with cheap money, you know, all of these ideas and all this debt, and we didn't get any growth. So their idea is, look, if the Messiah couldn't get us to 3% growth, how is Donald Trump going to do it? Well, he's doing it, and we can stay on that path of growth, and that's going to alleviate the problem. And then we just have to start cutting some government spending. It's okay. Have to start cutting government spending.
So let me explain why Steve is wrong.
Hey, so we've
because 3% won't do it.
We need 3.25.
We need 4.
Okay.
And a year and a half ago,
you got a deal, my
Jonathan. Friend. I hear 5.
Yeah. Okay. 4%.
But part of the deal is getting rid of tariffs. And I did a piece a few weeks ago about the uncertainty tax of Steve's and Larry's tariffs. I guess Trump had something to do with them too, but the fact that business people, some of you are business people, you don't know what your tariff is going to be, that reduces the incentive to invest more and hire more. And Steve, when you get back to Washington, sit down with Larry and Donald and Kevin and say, get rid of these tariffs, make a big announcement, unilateral free trade.
We're not going to have unilateral, but we are going
That'll give you 4%.
Richard, you don't want to.
Here's my prediction, folks. We are going to get a trade deal with China. Trump is going to win on China. Trump is going to cave in on this. We're going to see them reducing their tariffs and their trade barriers against the United States. We're going to sell more stuff to a country with 1.2 billion people. Once we get that trade deal done, you think the economy and stock market is strong right now? The economy's going through the roof if we get that trade deal done. It really is.
Well, but what do we do about China? I mean, the China issue is much more than just trade. The China issue is, stealing our technology, spying on us, doing everything. I forget the Russians. The Chinese are probably in this room. I know I'm being surveilled by the Chinese Communist Party because I've done some shows on China. That's a bigger issue than trade. Have you guys thought about that and how that plays? And because my fear is the Chinese are going to agree to a trade deal with Trump now to just kind of get him off their backs, and then when he's out of office, they're going to go right back to the same bad old stuff.
I'll make one quick observation about it. Look, this is everything. Trump has really kind of staked his presidency in getting this trade deal done with China. He will hit them with a 25% tariff if they don't come forward with a deal. And look, I support that. I mean, I don't want that to happen, but Trump cannot back down here. We are in a cold war right now with China. I really believe that. And right now, it's not being reported in the media, Bill. China's getting crushed by the 10% tariffs. I mean, they've got warehouses, they've got docks, they've got factories that are full of merchandise they can't sell with the 10% tariff. A 25% tariff is going to kill them. Their stock market's down 35%. So Trump understands the concept of leverage. As he told me many times in personal meetings, if we can't trade with China, we sneeze. If they can't trade with us, they catch pneumonia. And it is true. And so we're going to use that leverage to get them down. Final point, I want your observation of that. About this, Richard. I think China is just a big, big economic bubble that's going to burst. China has moved in the last seven or 8 years from this movement towards free markets to now it is a centrally planned economy. And what is the lesson of the last 100 years? Central planning doesn't work. I'm going to put my money. They keep saying, we're going to have all the new technologies and artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D imaging, all that stuff. Hell no, they're not. I'm going to put my money on Silicon Valley, not these central planners in China.
The Chinese financial system is the great Achilles heel.
Is it?
The manufacturing, they did ease up, and there's a lot of freedom in manufacturing in China. Mm-hmm. As they grew, of course, the financial sector becomes more important.
Yep.
most of the banks are state-owned or at least state-controlled. There are zombie banks because you had the political people making allocation decisions, as you always see when you have socialist banks, and that's what they have. And that's why you have, when you go to China, you see all these buildings, new buildings that are unoccupied, office buildings, housing, and so forth. It's because of misallocation of resources. Yep. And these banks are stuck with this. And the situation, as you point out, is only getting worse because Xi's basic instincts are not towards more freedom, they're towards more control.
Right.
And this is, you correctly point out, really the Achilles heel of China, and it could be a massive bubble. But when that bubble bursts,
it's going to hurt us.
It's going to hurt, well, the whole world.
Everybody. Okay, well, I'm going to have our little bubble burst here because we're about, Amy Green's going to, part two will continue of this panel in, I don't know which room, we're just down over here at 1:30, and we're going to continue this conversation. Jonathan, any final remarks that you would like to make?
Is North Dakota going to go to zero?
That is an actual good, very good point. I forgot to mention in my earlier remarks. As we're sitting here, the state of North Dakota, anybody from North Dakota?
Yeah.
There are a couple people. They may be the 10th no-income tax state. They actually, the House overwhelmingly passed the bill. Yeah, you can give that a round of applause. The House of Representatives actually passed a bill by about a 2-to-1 margin to not only repeal its personal income tax, but to repeal its business income tax as well. That would be the first time in state history we have seen a state do that because they are following the free market reforms that we talked about, and it's a direct result, to tie it all back into our topic today, of the benefits, the untold benefits of federal tax reform.
I want to make just one comment. On Monday, I've got an article coming out comparing three states, New York, Florida, and Virginia. And Bill earlier came up with a much better title than I had of her. He said, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I'm going to change the title
to that. You can have it.
I'm from Illinois, things are so bad in Illinois right now that Illinois is now losing population to West Virginia.
Okay. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, but we have Governor Gosnell in Virginia, so... it could be worse. Anyway, we will be reconvening at 1:30. Paul Teller will be joining us from the White House, and so he's going to be giving us some insights into what's happening in the West Wing. And I hope you all join us, and thanks, guys. It was a great conversation.